I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands which we're meeting today, pay my respects to elders both past and present, and to acknowledge any Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders who are here with us today. Unlike the two previous speakers who really focused on the system and the elements and how they're combined, what's broken, what's not, what works well, from the ABS perspective and from my sort of role, I want to sort of take you through a bit of a data journey and just show you how some of the consumers that Christine talked about earlier interact with the system, what are some of the demands that are being put on the system, and show you some of the things that those people tell us through our surveys and administrative data collections. So firstly, I'm just going to sort of just remind you that we actually do have a health system performance framework that's been adopted. So there is some broad systematic thinking around. I want to just talk to you about some of the data that's available that you might want to tap into at various stages in some of your thoughts, some of the future work that we're doing, particularly around health literacy that was mentioned earlier, and where to find some of that information. So I don't expect you to read this. This is the system performance framework, if you like. Basically, on the left are some of the determinants of health that we like to think about. The systems sort of described in the middle, that safety, appropriateness, effectiveness that the other speakers have talked about. They are sort of sitting in that space. And then the outcome really on the right-hand side is the health status of the elements that are there. Across the bottom, it really talks about the context, you know, how big our population is, what age distributions we have, some of the governance around it, the financing arrangements that we've heard about, the workforce that goes into that. And really across the top, it's picking up those equity types of elements that we talked about. So we talked about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, for example, and we've also talked about people with different socioeconomic backgrounds. All of that sort of stuff is picked up in that equity sort of component. So that's roughly the sort of things that we try to look at in terms of the data, but it's also one way of thinking about how the system connects and what are we trying to do. Okay, so as previous speakers have referred to, life expectancy is pretty good in terms of the broad picture. Men at the moment have a life expectancy of around 80 years and women nearly 85 years. Our infant mortality rate is one of the lowest in the world. The system helps in that, both in the preventative side as well as the treatment and management side of things. But as we've talked about before, we have some groups, particularly low socioeconomic areas, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander groups and people in remote areas, have relatively poorer outcomes. So one of the themes that you'll hear through the talk is about the disparities across different groups. And as we heard Andrew say, you know, some of the preventative factors like smoking, for example, come up in the burden of disease type studies that show about a third of our health conditions that we face could be reduced by reducing smoking, which we've been quite successful at, bringing it down from, you know, those high 50s and 60s. But having knowledge that the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander smoking rate currently sits at about 43%, so it's still very high, so the disparity there. High BMI, so Andrew also talked about the obesity levels there, and alcohol use and lack of physical activity there, and managing high blood pressure. And so there's a couple of areas of development there. So let's just have a look at the history of the life expectancy. So this takes the graph back to 1986, women having a nice steady growth and men having a slightly increased rate here and then sort of getting to around that 80 mark. So A, there's still a differential between men and women, and as you might remember that as I show you some differences in some of the activity patterns of using services, but also just acknowledging that even at the moment, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander life expectancy sits between 10 and 15 years below those lines. Okay, so it's quite a significant difference in that. So we need to think about that as in the broader health system. Australia sits pretty well internationally. So with Japan and Switzerland sitting just above us there. But we've for a long time, we've sat in that sort of top 5 or 10 positions for will continue to improve life expectancy on the whole. So we'll come back to that in a minute. So some of the demands that are putting on our system, so these are the causes of death, but clearly there's a whole bunch of treatments that happen right up until this point. A couple of things that I sort of wanted to sort of point out in this graph was really the very strong decline in ischemic heart disease. So that's coming through a combination of drug intervention and good treatments that are going on at critical points along that pathway. Obesity is not helping in that space, so it's an upward force, not a downward force in that space, and that also is the same in high blood pressure and also in the level of diabetes that we have as well. But the thing that really interests me here is that this real growth in the blue line here of dementia deaths that are going on. So this addresses the point that Andrew sort of made before about the multi-morbidity. Dementia is really just a collection of a whole bunch of things that are going on in many ways, because quite a lot of these people who are dying with dementia also have lots of other problems that are going on. It could be diabetes, respiratory disease, heart disease, arthritis, a whole bunch of things that are going on all at the same time, and dementia is just one of those having combinations of those sorts of things as well. Lung cancer has continued to fall, but we'll still see a sort of a cohort effect still going on in that space, because we're still picking up all of those people who've been exposed to the high levels of smoking 20 years ago. So those sorts of diseases really put a lot of demand on the system to try and manage, not only individually but as a group. So I want to just talk to you briefly about a really interesting survey that we run. It's only a little one, about 27,000 people do it regularly, pretty much every year. We ask people about these sorts of topics, about access to all sorts of services, any barriers that they run into, GPs used in terms of their preferred GP and hours of care, long-term health conditions, so we understand what that and their health status and the coordination of that care. So I'm just going to give you a couple of results from this survey so that you can follow these up on our website. So looking at this graph, this is about the use of health services. And in this case, we're looking at the use of a general practitioner. So in this case, women use general practitioners more than men. Now, you've got to remember, in using this, that they may not necessarily all be using it for themselves. Okay, they may be taking children along. They may be also taking others along that they're caring for as well. So need to be really careful about that, but this is what they are reporting to us. This is the dental professional usage, much lower. And this goes back to Ian's point around the cost of the co-payment sort of arrangement. How much do you need to contribute into paying for your dental care? And in fact, there was a report out a week or so ago from the dental people that sort of showed the relative paucity of use of dental services, the backlog in the public dental service system, and the barriers that people have in accessing those services. And then this sort of smaller proportion of people who use medical specialists. So when we talk about cost or delays to fill a prescription or didn't see a health professional, and this one focuses on primarily on the cost sorts of issues, and only about 4% of people sort of didn't go and see a GP because of cost. So hence the underpinning of the GP through Medicare. Medical specialists a bit higher there, but dentistry is really high. 18% of people saying cost is a real barrier in this space. Prescriptions, quite often people go to their GP, they get a prescription from that GP, but only 7% don't fill that because of the cost issue. They may not fill it also because of other reasons. Access, they feel better, they change their mind, they don't want to take that drug, a whole range of other things as well, but if you're just looking at cost, it's about 7%. Waiting times, this is all quite often an issue. People don't go and see their GP because they're concerned about how long the wait might be, but of people who did go and see become a GP. 18% of people said that they waited longer than acceptable. So that's a judgment for themselves about whether that's a convenience issue or whether it's the acceptability around the condition that they're trying to manage at the time. And this is a bit higher for medical specialists as well, and so they're waiting even longer for that access to, around there. So this is a graph that looks at the use of the emergency departments, which I think we talked about briefly before. And this just shows you the age distribution. It's not surprising in terms of the age distribution here, with some older people accessing emergency departments much more than those in the middle age groups. And the primary driver for people going to emergency is access to an ambulance and an ambulance delivering them to an emergency department, not just people fronting up in specifically for the older age groups. But when we ask people who fronted up to an emergency department, the condition that you were being treated for, what proportion of people thought that that actually could have been dealt with by a GP? And about 17% of people said, look, on reflection, that whatever I was being managed for in the emergency department could have been dealt with by my local GP. So that's a really big impost on that emergency care system, very high cost compared to a much lower cost in the GP environment. So that's quite a big impact on the system. This talks about out-of-hours care for access for use of GPs. The one element that I wanted to pick out here is this bar here. And this is a really significant increase between 2013-14 and 16-17 in the use of home visit care arrangements. This is a real shift in the system that's been put in place, where there's a much higher proportion of people ringing up those after-hours care services and having a doctor come to visit them. There's a real shift in behaviour there. This is for, the reasons for people 45 years over and over for not seeing a GP, from a different survey, but very similar to the patient experience one. Cost being one of the reasons here. Cost for 45 to 64 years was more of an issue, whereas for those who are 65 years and over, less of an issue. No GP nearby, small proportion. Could not get an appointment was quite a large proportion here, so that's about accessibility there. Other reasons is a really bunch of convenience for the ones they change their mind and give you all of those sorts of things. So we talked about mental health before as being one of the parts that are quite challenging in the system to manage. We've done a really important linkage between the census and the MBS and PBS data in an aggregate sense, and try to look at the characteristics, and there's a really wonderful piece on our website that you might like to go and explore. But here's just one graph from that, where you can see that there's a really big change in the way that we use MBS-related services. So these are, if you like, in the broad, talking-like therapies, interacting with a clinician in some way. It could be a GP, it could be a psychologist, it could be a psychiatrist or a counsellor in some way that's charging against MBS, versus how much drug use is being used through different layers as well. And as you can see, but as people get older, the drug use really ramps up quite significantly, but those interactive type therapies really drop away. Now, what I didn't show in this pack of slides is that when you look at the differences between urban type settings and rural type settings, this graph it plays out very strongly as well. In that rural type settings get very high levels of drug prescribing, but very little access to talking type therapies. But in urban areas, there's a much better balance. And when you look at that same pattern for socioeconomic breakdown as well, you get the same sort of thing as well. So it's really interesting. We're working on it at the moment. Yes, we're trying to put all of the data sets together for more recent years so I can get to a time trend. Yeah, a good question. We're really keen to explore that in further. So this piece of information is from the National Health Survey, and just talks about the pattern of people who report their health as excellent or very good, good or fair. And you can see this real differential in the fair and poor sorts of one across different age groups there as well. I didn't want to focus on that one too much. So we talked about private health insurance. This is what we get some people reporting their private health insurance patterns. You can see sort of a slight increase there, but this data goes up to 14, 15, but we do know that that's sort of plateaued and fallen past that using some of the, this is survey-based data, and we know from the administrative type data we can see some patterns changing there as well. So this is the point of this private health insurance component is to think about what's the relative socioeconomic status. So we've split it up into quintiles here, and you can see clearly the top quintile to the right is taking up private health insurance at a much higher rate than the people of low socioeconomic status as well. Okay, so just wanted to talk about the demand on the system. Again, so last time I showed you the sort of the cause of death sorts of numbers, but this shows you the sort of the reported long-term health conditions that people have that we're trying to manage through the system. And you can see that very, very high demand around, arthritis and asthma in that space, hypertension, and mental and behavioural conditions, 4 million people, so tops it out there. So very high demand. But interesting, Andrew sort of pointed out the disproportionate sort of applications to PBAC around sort of drug interventions when you've got that level of burden in the community. So this is just a couple of things to finish off with. This is about the overweight and obesity sort of levels. 63% of Australians are overweight or obese, 71% in men, 56% in women, and 27% of children. So the 27% of children is the real concern here, because we're really setting ourselves up for really strong poor health outcomes in that cohort as they come through. I'm going to do something about that. 1 in 7 people are daily smokers, and 26% of men consume more than 2 standard drinks per day. So that's putting us at risk as well, and 9% of women. And this is the age distribution here, and really it's the very high levels of obesity in this age group here, which are going to sort of really continue to tax the health system as, hypertension continues to increase. Diabetes is there. Through the Australian Health Survey, we have detected 30% of people had undiagnosed diabetes. And you're going to start getting renal failure going on in that space as well, so that will continue to put more and more demand on the system. And you can see that real shift between 1995 and 2014 really makes a much greater demand right across the whole age spectrum, not just in one particular age cohort. And this is the cholesterol sort of picture. People who reported that they had high cholesterol as the green, but when we tested them, tested their blood, a whole bunch of people had very high cholesterol levels on top of that and didn't know about it. So that's the sort of the sleeping giant as well. So that's there. So I just wanted to finish off going back to life expectancy. So as you can see in that graph, the life expectancy continues to increase. So from my perspective, it's not about the overall macro picture anymore. It's about what's underneath those data. Who are the groups who are more at risk in this space? We've talked about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. We've talked about people of lower socioeconomic background. In some part, I've talked about the sort of the rural-urban divide is an issue. But one of the groups that we have focused on is that there are almost like two groups of migrants. Those who come being really quite healthy and really maintain their health, but then there are relatively recent migrant groups who also have really poor health outcomes as well. And that comes down to issues like health literacy and system navigation that Christine sort of mentioned. not being able to sort of take advantage of screening programs, not being aware of the vaccination programs, not being aware or capable of taking advantage of our primary health network. And so you end up with some poor health outcomes in that space. If you want to have a look at any of those data that I've quickly taken you through in any way, I'm very happy to help you with the with that, or if you want to just go to the ABS website, it's pretty easy to find most of that data. Thank you very much.